Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to Dark Poutine. I'm Mike Brown, creator and host on a new Mac this week. Thank goodness. With me today is my good friend, Matthew.
Hello.
You wrote this episode.
I wrote this episode.
Wow. What a relief. Although I did write another episode this week anyway, because you're going away and then we're taking a week off.
Oh, I thought it was like a backup episode in case you hated this one.
No, there's no such thing. We don't have backup episodes.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Our content is often intense, and some listeners may find it disturbing. We're not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We're two ordinary Canadian schmucks chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
A deal at twice the price.
A deal at twice the price. That doesn't sound like a deal.
No, even if you paid double, it's still a deal. That's how good of a deal it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Between 1974 and 1976, a series of rapes and murders took place in and around the small town of Strathroy in southwestern Ontario, perpetrated by Christian Herbert Harold McGee. He sexually assaulted and murdered three women and raped two others. This is Dark Poutine, episode 187, The Mad Slasher of Strathroy. And so you were really, really looking forward to this episode. I have never seen you come in so quickly, put your headphones on, and sit down.
Well, this is my hometown, right?
Yeah, this is your hometown.
These are my people.
They're your peeps.
Yeah.
How aware of this case were you before?
You know, once I started looking into it, because I knew I wanted to write some episodes.
Yep.
And then I was like, well, actually, you know, London, Ontario region, you know, has had like a lot of serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, well, but one of them was from Strathroy, because I can remember my great-grandmother.
Right.
Once saying, this guy was a bad man. And I didn't have that memory until I started doing this research.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Right. And then I found...
Not cool that there was a bad man, but cool that you had the memory.
And then so I started talking to family members and one of them went all through school with him.
Oh, wow.
I've interviewed her for this episode. And Strathroy has been in the news, unfortunately, mm-hmm. lately. So
yeah.
Do you remember that ISIS supporter, Aaron Driver, who blew himself up in the back of a taxi?
No, I don't remember that at all.
Last year, a couple years ago.
Okay, yeah.
He was on his way to a shopping mall or something. That was in Strathroy.
Mm-hmm.
And Nathaniel Veltman, who's a terrorist accused of running down that Muslim family in London.
Right. So it's alleged at this point, even though everybody...
Accused, alleged. Yeah. And his family's from Strathroy. He was working in Strathroy. So.
And that happened really close to where you grew up. Around London has a really interesting history in that way. At one point, people were calling it the serial killer capital of the world.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah, per capita, the region had more serial killers than anywhere else.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So over to you, Matthew. Tell us the story.
Thanks, Mike. The best description I've ever read of Southwestern Ontario was written by Margaret Atwood in her introduction to the Nobel Prize winning author Alice Munro's book, Carried Away. Have you read either of those?
No, authors? I haven't. No.
They're amazing. This description is so accurate that I actually felt it in my bones when I first read it, right? Mm. So here's some excerpts from the beginning of that book. So quote, Southwestern Ontario was nicknamed Sowesto by legendary Canadian artist Greg Curnow, and it's a name that stuck. I'm actually a good friend of Greg's daughter, Zoe.
Oh, cool.
Curnow's view was that Sowesto was an area of considerable interest, but also of considerable psychic murkiness and oddity, a view shared by many. Author Robertson Davies, also from Southwestern Ontario, used to say, "I know the dark folkways of my people."
Now, I don't want to cut in on a quote here, but that's interesting to me.
What's that?
There are considerable psychic murkiness and oddities in Sowesto.
Yeah.
So what are some of those? Do you get into that later on, or is that something?
Well, it's just, I think part of it is the history of the place, right? And I'll get into a little bit, but there's, you know, it's like a small farming towns, but like so many horrible, horrible things happened.
Right.
That it's just this weird area.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So continue with your quote.
Okay. "You're likely to run into a few signs in Sowesto wheat fields telling you to be prepared to meet your God or else your doom." Felt very much to be the same thing. The country is mostly flat farmland cut by several wide winding rivers prone to flooding. And on the rivers, a number of towns grew up in the 19th century. Each has its own brick town hall, usually with a tower. Each its post office building, its handful of churches of various denominations. Each its main street and residential section of gracious homes, and its other residential section on the wrong side of the tracks. Each has its families with long memories and stashes of bones in its closets.
You're painting a picture of like a really interesting sort of suburban small town area.
Yeah.
And I don't want to use the word cookie cutter because that would not be correct, but it sounds quaint.
Well, so many of the towns are sort of similar in many ways, right?
Yeah.
Sowesto contains the site of the famous Donnelly Massacre of the 19th century, when a large family was slaughtered and their home burnt as a result of political resentments carried over from Ireland.
As far as the Donnellys go, I haven't covered them yet.
Mm.
They are much covered. But interestingly, you being from the area, maybe it is you who should write our Donnelly Massacre.
Why not? We learned about it in school when I was a kid.
Exactly, and I didn't.
Yeah,
because I'm from Nova Scotia. We learned about the Mi'kmaq people.
Okay.
And
everyone knew about the Donnellys when we were growing up.
Oh, there you go.
It was like the story that held on, right?
So please tell me that story. I've read a couple of books, and
I'll write an episode on the Donnellys.
That would be fantastic.
And I'll put the little Matthew twist on it somehow.
Cool.
She goes on to write, "Lush nature, repressed emotions, respectable fronts, hidden sexual excesses, outbreaks of violence, lurid crimes, long-held grudges, strange rumors, none are very far away in Monroe's Sowesto, partly because all have been provided by the real life of the region itself," end quote. I'm from one of those towns, Strathroy. It's on the Sydenham River with its own red brick town hall. Yes, we have a tower. Its own post office, its churches of various denominations. And in fact, my family actually helped build the United Church.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So did you grow up in the United Church?
Yeah.
Oh, so did I.
Yeah. I mean, we were kind of atheists, but I think my mom sent me there to get me out of the house.
I had to go to Sunday school, and I loathed every moment of it. The way Sunday school worked there, I think it was like, okay, take the kids away while the parents have the actual sermon.
Right.
Because the kids aren't, it's going to go over the kids' heads. And
yeah, I did Sunday school, but the parents didn't actually go to the
church. Oh, the parents didn't go?
No.
Oh, there you go.
Strathroy really has had it more than its fair share of lurid crimes over the years.
Yeah.
And when I say I'm from there, I'm like really from there, Mike. My family were the early settlers. I'm actually fifth generation Strathroyan.
Strathroyan.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds very regal.
Believe me, it's not. So you can say that I too kind of know the dark folkways of my people.
Well,
right?
There you go. So you know how to, like, I don't know, raise a dead beaver and
yeah, exactly.
All those kind
exactly.
of things.
And you know, the long family memories. I'm going to tap in on some of those because one of my family members went to school with this murderer.
Cool.
So I tapped into some of these memories for this episode by talking to someone who knew him well, McGee well. She refers to him as Chris because that's how she knew him.
Yep.
She's a relative of mine. And for the show, I'm going to call her Stella.
Okay. So she didn't want to be named.
Well, I just thought, you know, and Stella, she thought was kind of a cool name. So,
okay. There you go.
Her earliest memories of McGee were when the one-room schoolhouses that had once dotted the countryside outside of Strathroy were amalgamated in the early 1960s into a central school in Metcalfe Township, and she ended up in the same school with him.
Oh, wow.
But my mom went to school in a one-room schoolhouse with an outhouse, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, that is really...
Like Little House on the Prairie sort of stuff.
I went to the same elementary school as my mother did. So, okay. I mean, it's been torn down now because it was old then. But, but yeah, I went to a proper elementary school and so did she.
Yeah.
We actually had the same grade four teacher.
Okay.
Me and my mom. So I understand what small towns are.
I had the same grade six teacher as my father.
Oh, wow.
And I can remember first day of school.
Mm-hmm.
She's going down the list and she gets to Stockton, Matthew, and she finally looks up after reading all the, and she goes, "You wouldn't happen to be the son of Alan, would you?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "I certainly hope you were a better student than he was." And looks down and keeps doing the roll call. And I was like, "I'm so fucked this year."
Oh, no. So what did Stella talk to you about?
She's saying that the powers that be wanted to get all the new kids into the school as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the school actually wasn't even quite finished. You know, there's probably some political thing like, hey, the one-room schoolhouses are gone. We have the new shiny Metcalfe Central School.
With two rooms.
Yeah, exactly. And she said that she remembers there are literally mountains of dirt from construction. And kids being kids, she said, we played on those mountains of dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And that Chris, she kind of described him as sort of always lurking in the periphery. Right?
Oh, okay, like I remember those kind of kids.
He didn't like really super engage, but mm-hmm. he was always there. And she said what was weird is he didn't play with any kids his own age. He hung out with the young girls and just sort of watched them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an elementary school, right?
Right.
And, you know, she said we were like 5 or 6 years younger than he was,
mm-hmm.
but he always wanted to hang around where we were playing.
Wow.
And she said when I think back about that, it's really creepy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Especially with what he went on to do.
Well, I made that memory for her, I think, unfortunately, a bit creepier because she hadn't heard this. After he was arrested for these murders and rapes as an adult, it came out that at the age of 12, he had sexually assaulted a girl at 10 at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
So something that was obviously, you know, because he was a youth. It was kept under wraps, but it all came out in the court case. And I think when I told her that, I think she's like, oh my God, that's so weird.
So that would be around the time that she knew him, obviously.
Yeah, a couple of years later, probably.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. She had another memory of this time, which kind of freaked me out. She said all the girls my age like to skip.
Mm-hmm. Skipping rope.
Yeah, jump rope.
Right? Yeah.
And I love how she said, she's like, we had all the mad moves, right?
Yeah.
And he would hang around the periphery and watch. And she said she remembered him giving all the girls nicknames, and they're all dogs' names.
Huh.
He called her Skippy because she skipped so much. Other girls he named things like Rover and Rex, right? Always dog names. And this bit sort of creeped me out.
No kidding, because like...
Well, it'll creep you out even more when we get further down the story.
Okay.
Right, because when I think about the job he had later in life and how he killed people, it just freaks me out that,
okay.
you know, this sort of weird obsession started so early. She also described McGee as trying to look like Elvis Presley.
Okay.
So she said he always had this sort of short-waisted jacket and his hair was always black and slicked back and... She said that maybe there's product in it, but she thinks that maybe it was just
unwashed
because yeah. she said I think he was from a broken sort of abusive home.
Yeah. The news articles that I've read support this, that young McGee grew up in an emotionally and physically abusive home. And according to Christian McGee himself, both his parents berated him all the time, telling him he wouldn't amount to anything. They lived on the poverty line, and his father eventually took him out of school to work at a young age to help make ends meet, leaving McGee functionally illiterate.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different time, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people...
Yeah, like, okay, you need to go to work to help the family earn some money, so we don't care whether you can read or not. We're going to yank you out of school.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And
that had to be weird for a kid, too. I guess it was more accepted as a practice at that time.
Well, especially in farming communities,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I remember when we were getting the, what do you call that? Not when you study for a full year, semester system.
Yep.
And all the parents who were farmers of the kids were upset because sometimes they had to do the harvest.
Yeah, right? So they would have to yank the kid out of school at important times in the semester.
Which would mean in a semester when it's shorter, then they're missing more. So yeah, so that's sort of the community I'm from, right? And it's a good old farming community. Stella also said to me that, you know, he always seemed to be a bit of a broken kid without friends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was like, it's really interesting. I found she's like, God, we were just little kids, you know, and she's thinking how sad his life was like the way it is and that it turned out to do what he did.
Yeah. Because, yeah, you know somebody. I remember kids that I grew up around who didn't have the best lives either, and some of them turned out just fine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there are always those ones that stand out, those memories that stand out. It's like, oh, yeah, that guy ended up in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're like, no surprise there.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
So that's fast forward from the 1960s to the late evening of Friday, 1st of March, 1974. Mm-hmm. It was a cold night and a fog had rolled into town. I was 3 at the time. I was most likely snuggled up at home in bed, just a 15-minute walk away from where this crime scene actually took place.
Oh, wow.
Judith Barksey, who had a shift at a nursing home later that night, walked from her home on Maitland Terrace to the Mother's Pizza on Frank Street. That's just to give you a feeling, it's about an 8-minute walk from her house to the pizza place.
So pretty local.
Yeah.
Right in the hood.
Yeah. Well, everything is in a small town, right?
Yeah.
She went to pick up some food before her shift, and she had previously actually worked at Mother's Pizza, so was there chatting and joking around with some of the staff members before she headed back towards her home with her meal.
So everybody knows everybody. It's a small town.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, hey, how you doing, Judith? You know, haven't seen you in a couple of days.
Yeah, this is early 70s. There's probably about 6,000 people that lived in this town.
Not large. Right?
And on her way home, she walked past a place called the News Depot. Mm-hmm. Towards a shortcut across the railroad tracks. As she started walking back home, perhaps she was thinking about how far she'd come. So Judith had a few tough breaks in her life, Mike, having been through a series of foster homes as a child.
Yeah.
But now here she was. She was, you know, the age of 19. She was renting a place on her own. She was working at a nursing home. Actually, the nursing home was just behind my house, past the field. I used to joke to my mom, when she got old, I just give her a suitcase and make her walk across the field.
Oh, dear.
But, you know, she's a few weeks away from graduating as a nurse's aide. Sorry, she was a few weeks away from graduating as a nurse's aide.
Mm-hmm.
A compassionate job. I think that really takes a compassionate person. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, because you're dealing with people who need taken care of.
Yeah, and I like people like Judith, right? People who overcome these obstacles in their lives and don't let the tough breaks they have define them. Mm-hmm. You know, she was getting on with her life after a shitty time, right? She had her whole life ahead of her, that is, until she passed McGee, who was exiting the News Depot just as she was going past.
Okay, so here's where she meets Christian McGee.
Yeah, so McGee had been watching hockey that night at home and decided to come downtown to buy, of all things, raffle tickets at the News Depot. As he left the shop, he spotted Judith walking past and began to follow her. He knew Judith and she knew him, but not that well, as she didn't really stop to talk to the dark figure following her in the fog. From the evidence, it seems that Judith eventually started running from him once he pulled out a knife, dropping her food as she ran. She made it to a phone booth to call for help, but by that time, McGee had caught up with her, promptly slashing her throat before fondling her while she lied dying on the ground.
Oh, geez.
Stealing $10 in change that she had, washing his jackknife in a nearby puddle, and walking back home with his raffle tickets to his wife.
So he's married by this time, has a wife at home.
Yeah.
You know, that old chestnut of people saying, oh, serial killers are these creepy guys who live by themselves, these loners. No. They are not.
No.
Many, many, many times, as we have learned on this show,
they have lives.
They have a life with a wife, kids. They have a job that they go to every week without fail.
Yeah.
But they do things like this.
Yeah. And, you know, just like that, in just that few seconds, Judith was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Her life snuffed out in a really brutal way. Later, when he was asked what was going through his mind at the time and why he did it, he simply said, she looked good from behind.
Oh, God.
I know.
That just reminded me of my monster.
Yeah.
You know, following me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really took me back.
Just a last minute sort of, oh, yeah. I like the look of that.
Yeah. It was a crime of opportunity.
Yeah.
it wasn't one that he had planned. He hadn't been stalking her forever. He'd probably seen her around town.
Yeah, and just saw her walking past him and right then and there.
Now's the time.
Yeah. Someone found her body the next day. He stumbled upon a trail of food. So a bottle of grapefruit juice, a bottle of orange crush, a pizza, a coffee crisp. Then he saw one shoe that she had run out of in her panic. Mm. And the trail eventually led towards the phone booth. The receiver is swaying in the cold March wind and her body was close by.
Yeah.
Police investigations determined McGee was a person of interest as witnesses had placed him near the scene at the time.
So they knew he could have been involved early on in the investigation.
Yeah, you just wait. He keeps on popping onto the radar.
Of course.
Right? But there was no evidence against him. So he remained just a person of interest before the case went cold. The Mad Slasher, as he became known, had got away with it.
So the first murder is done. The first murder that we know of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because with these guys, sometimes the murders that we learn about are not the only ones that they've committed.
No.
The murders that the police can talk about are not the only ones that they've committed.
So McGee went quiet for the next number of months until June of 1975, when a young woman of 18, who we'll call Anna to protect her privacy, was walking through Alexander Park. So now, Mike, Alexander is a large park in the middle of Strathroy, cut in half by Victoria Street. Mm-hmm. The Sydenham River runs through it. And like Margaret Atwood's quote, it often floods.
Yeah.
And on the west side of the park, it floods every spring. It's a park I spent a lot of time in as a kid. Mm-hmm. It had different areas, a baseball field where I learned to play t-ball, a pond, a trail, and there's a forested area and a boardwalk that takes you over sort of this marsh filled with skunk cabbage, and the town swimming pool's on the other side. And as she was walking through the park, enjoying the early summer day, McGee was waiting for her and jumped her from behind and tried to rape her. But while he was trying to take her jeans off, the zipper broke in the struggle, which frustrated McGee, so he then choked her into unconsciousness before fondling her and leaving her for dead on the side of the road.
Holy jeez.
So this woman was a survivor, though, and lived to tell the story. She was able to give a description of McGee, which didn't seem to matter, as he remained free to kill again later that year.
And kill he did.
Yes.
On the 20th of October, 1975, a young 19-year-old mother, Patricia Jenner, was in her white and pink shuttered frame house in Mount Bridges, just a few miles down Highway 81 from Strathroy. She'd just put her six-month-old baby down for a nap and was probably looking forward to her husband coming home from work when there was a knock on her door. It was McGee. Patricia knew Christian McGee, so she invited him in. Maybe a conversation started, and eventually a box of photographs came out and they started to look at them together. Suddenly, McGee attacked, ripping off her clothes and beginning to rape before he suddenly stopped and told her to get dressed. McGee later said his morals and respect for her made him initially stop, but then he snapped. So what I think is going on at this point is that he was unable to compartmentalize this crime.
Mm.
Like some serial killers will only kill strangers because they are objects to them.
Mm-hmm.
And Patricia was not an object to Christian McGee. So he wasn't able to
separate it somehow.
To separate, and he wasn't able to continue
because
he saw her as a person.
Yeah.
As Patricia was dressing, probably shaking and in fear for herself and her baby, McGee came up behind her with her black shoelace and strangled her before slashing her throat. So probably in that time that he had realized, well, I can't go through with this.
But I can't just leave now.
But right? I can't just leave now. She knows who I am. She's going to tell somebody.
Yeah.
So he, in his mind,
had to
murder her.
Yeah.
He then rummaged around the house, stealing $40 before leaving. That evening, Dennis Jenner, Patricia's husband, came home to find his wife's body on the kitchen floor, blood smeared, family photos scattered across the room. The baby, thankfully, was unharmed and in her bed. I can't imagine how horrible that would have been for Dennis coming home like that, just another day of work, and find the woman you love like laying on the floor in a pool of blood. I also think about that baby, who'd be about our age now, had to grow up without her mom.
Yeah.
And I really hope life has been good to her and that she's flourished despite this tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you think about it, like, this is, that baby was, we're probably the same age as that kid at the tournament, right?
You know, and all of a sudden mom's gone.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about the husband having to explain that to this child. Where did mommy go?
Yeah.
How do you explain to a baby as they grow that your mother was killed in another room while you were there sleeping, that there was a murderer in another room?
Horrible, isn't it?
Yeah. Luckily, small towns have nosy neighbors, and an elderly neighbor next door was able to give a description that fit the two other cases. Yeah. The neighbor was also able to give a description of the car, a yellow, older model Oldsmobile, which matched McGee's father's car. What caught the attention of the neighbor initially was how McGee, after pulling into the driveway, stood for a very long time listening at the door before he knocked.
That's creepy.
What I think he was doing was listening at the door before he knocked to ensure that the husband wasn't home.
Yeah, probably.
Is it just the woman and the baby, you know? Because if you knock and the husband's home, how do you explain your presence?
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to do what you end up doing. Hmm. So this is definitely, he planned this situation. Who knows if he went there to actually murder her, but I definitely believe he went there to sexually assault her.
Yeah.
Kristen McGee was picked up for questioning by both the Strathroy police and the OPP. The police had connected him to both victims, but in a small town like Strathroy, almost everybody knows everybody else, and without evidence or confession, they had to let him go.
Yeah.
It didn't take him any time to strike again. At this point, he changed his modus operandi. The police had talked to him about how he knew the two women who were killed, so he began looking for strangers a bit further out of town. And who better to attack than random hitchhikers?
Yep.
So there you go. That sort of proves my theory about killing and sexually assaulting the people who you know is a lot harder than
random strangers.
Random strangers, people who you have no connection to at all. Yep. He didn't care about these random strangers. He can ogle them, he can leer at them, he can do whatever he wants with them because he has no emotional feeling about them.
Yeah.
It can be all about his lust and his rage. Of course, the largest benefit of murdering strangers is that Christian McGee had no connection to them at all, and it would make it much harder for the police to trace a murder or rape or whatever crime he was committing back to him. We'll take a short break right here, and when we come back, Matthew will continue with the story.
A few weeks later, on the 3rd of November 1975, a 19-year-old girl, who we'll call Beth to protect her identity, was hitchhiking to London, Ontario, which is just about half an hour from Strathroy. Hitchhiking, you know, Mike, you and I have discussed this, hitchhiking was common in the mid-1970s. Unfortunately, it was McGee who picked her up. She told him where she was headed, but McGee had other plans and drove her to a secluded side road, violently raped her, smashed her over the head with a glass bottle, fracturing her skull, and rolled her into the ditch beside the road to leave her to die. But this girl was a fighter. She survived the ordeal. She actually spent, Mike, over a month at recovering in the hospital from a fractured skull and was able to give, again, another description of McGee to the police. But unbelievably, even at this point, he wasn't arrested. The police somehow still did not manage to connect the dots, leaving him free to strike one final time.
It was a little ways away. So, okay, we'll give them a break at this point.
Frustrating, though, isn't it?
It is frustrating. Yeah. Like, there can't be that many predators in this area. But at the same time, like we said earlier, he's changed his modus operandi.
Yeah.
He's now decided that he's going to take on killing strangers. So Strathroy cops are looking at, we're looking for Christian McGee to do it again here.
Yeah, or for somebody to do it again here, right.
Yeah.
And it was the 70s, right? I think the police have gotten a lot better since then.
For sure.
You know, the following summer, on the 15th of June, 1976, 15-year-old Susan Scholes was dropped off in Forest, Ontario by her brother.
So Forest is not a very creative name for a town. Let's call this place Forest because it's a very wooded area.
Yeah.
Like,
what would we call this area?
We would call this area books.
Books.
Books and stuff.
Books and stuff.
Yeah.
River. Yeah, that's kind of like naming a town river.
Right.
Or field.
Well, Bridgewater was named Bridgewater because there are
a bridge and water.
Or three bridges over the water.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, near Forest, you know, if you think of her mindset at the time, Mike, school's out, long summer of fun ahead of her.
Nice.
Swimming, sunshine, hanging out with friends. Her brother had actually dropped her off on his way to work, and she said she's going to find her way back to the family cottage on Hillsborough Beach. It's on Lake Huron, just 20 minutes down the road past Ipperwash and Kettle Point from my old family cottage in Port Franks, for listeners who might know the area. Doing my research, I really felt for her brother. Can you imagine you drop off your sibling and it's the last time you see them alive?
Well, yeah.
Like it just, when I was doing this research, I just felt so badly for him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't deserve this hell. She didn't deserve this hell, or her parents. It should have been just this beautiful summer on the shores of Lake Huron.
Yeah, it's the best time of year for a young person is summer, like, because you actually have some freedom. Summers in Canada, well, it depends on where you are, but summers in Eastern Canada that I recall are hot.
Yeah.
Lots of swimming, like you mentioned, and just a good time, you know?
Yeah. Should have been the halcyon days of youth, but this fucker came around and turned it into a nightmare, right?
Yeah.
So after buying batteries, she stuck out her thumb on the side of the road. She was last seen alive at 1:30 p.m. by a forklift driver who was driving slowly down the road. The same day at 4:30 p.m., a James Frayne, a farmer, was driving his tractor down a dirt road and found Susan's body. He didn't really go up to it too much. He quickly jumped back on his tractor and raced home as fast as he can go in a tractor.
He sees this body laying on a dirt road, and rather than touch it, he was a smart guy.
Yeah.
Rather than touch it, took off home, made some phone calls.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would do. What would you do in that situation? You find a body. Obviously, probably I would want to check to see if the person was alive, but maybe, I don't know what state she was in. She might have been very obviously deceased.
She was. Yeah. I think if somebody looks obviously deceased, I've watched enough Law and Order
to know not to.
Yeah. Not to step on anything.
Yeah.
Right. Once he called the police, they came. She had been raped, strangled, her throat slashed, and there was a slash over her pubic area.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting to see him further developing.
Yeah. It's like his crimes are getting more brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was no weapon found at the scene.
Mm-hmm.
The news spread quickly in the small community, and the driver of the forklift told the police that he saw Susan get into a 1975 Ford pickup truck owned by a John Grimson's company.
Mm-hmm.
He had been going slowly down the road, he's in a forklift, and easily saw her get into the truck in his rearview mirror. The police spoke to Grimson that day, who told them that Christian McGee, an employee of his, had been using the truck that day.
Oh no.
Yeah. So Grimson had a company that, remember when I talked about how he called all the girls' dogs' names?
Yeah.
So Grimson had a company that picked roadkill off of the side of the road.
Oh, no.
So McGee was employed to pick up dead animals like dogs that got hit by cars off the side of the road.
Mm.
A job that one colleague of his said, quote, he just seemed to enjoy too much. So that fact kind of freaks me out and maybe goes into his mindset of seeing women as these dogs, right? Or these animals, and that he sort of dehumanizing what he's done is to completely dehumanize these women, right?
Yeah, it's like even his use of nicknames, dog nicknames when he was a child was dehumanizing and belittling to these.
I mean, I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but when I heard my relative tell that part of the story and then read this part, just sort of connected in my head.
Right? Yeah.
So he had absolutely no compassion at all for these women and these girls, right?
So the next day on the 16th at 3:27 p.m., an OPP cruiser and an unmarked police vehicle arrived at Christian McGee's employer's farm. As soon as the marked cruiser was shifted into park, McGee opened the passenger door and got in without saying a word.
Isn't that incredible?
I know why you're here.
Like, literally, they parked and he just walked up and got into the back of the car.
He was brought in for questioning, where he admitted to picking Susan up but denied killing her. He told them that he dropped her off. Police held him and got a warrant to search his home and truck, where they found grass that was identified as the same grass where her body was found, blood on his clothes, and a filleting knife that had no blood, but was consistent with the slashes on Susan's body. we know that he will already clean his weapon because he did that with his jackknife in the puddle.
Yeah.
The trial held before the Supreme Court of Ontario lasted 8 days. Testimony was given by one of the surviving women who identified him as her rapist. Testimony was also given by 4 psychiatrists and 1 psychologist, labeling him as a dangerous psychopath with severe personality disorder. McGee testified in court in his own defense, and throughout the entire trial, he denied killing Susan. The jury deliberated for a little over 3 hours. They found him not guilty on the grounds of insanity, and he was remanded into psychiatric care at the maximum security ward at the Penetanguishene Mental Health Center, now named Waypoint. He was subsequently charged with the murders of Judy Barksy and Louise Jenner, as well as the assaults and rapes of the 2 other women. McGee gave written and signed statements admitting to these murders and assaults. He was again found not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, let's fast forward to 2004. McGee, some say, had been a model prisoner until that point, and he applied to be moved to a medium secure unit in downtown Toronto on Queen Street West, where he could eventually be given day parole. A serial killer is moving toward day parole.
Yeah.
Just think about that.
Yeah.
Psychologist Dr. Philip Klassen wrote a report supporting this request, which read, quote, "This gentleman's fantasies involving torture, dismemberment, and cannibalism with respect to his victims is also consistent with the diagnosis of sexual sadism, as is a history of post-mortem sexually related activities." So, necrophilia.
Mm-hmm.
"This gentleman's history suggests to me that this gentleman could be managed on a medium secure unit with respect to both aggressive behavior and elopement risk."
I don't understand how that sentence can start with what he's saying, but then at the end say, yeah, but put him into
a... He did all these things, but we'll manage him
and he still fantasizes about them, but we can put him into a medium.
Yeah, he'll be fine there.
Yeah.
In 2005, the Provincial Review Board approved Christian McGee's transfer to the medium secure unit and ordered the Penetanguishene facility to release him to the Toronto facility. However, the staff at the Penetanguishene facility refused to do it, saying he was, quote, "a sadistic serial murderer," and that, quote, "Mr. McGee has a number of risk factors which combine to make him a very high-risk candidate for any form of release." Well, surprise. Susan Scholl's brother was there as well, and he said, "McGee should never get out. There's nothing much more to say than that."
Mike, when I was doing the research on the show, it's the family members through the years of all of his requests for paroles, et cetera, were always there. Mm. So they held on and they kept fighting, which is just amazing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Cheryl Duggan, whose sister Lynn was murdered in North Vancouver, I had her on the show.
Yeah.
She still is dealing with this. And it was in the 90s that Lynn, her sister, was murdered.
Yeah.
So she still goes to all the parole hearings. She was just recently texting me about parole hearings. So there are a lot of families who will see this through.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's only one person in the family who can bear it.
Yeah.
Penetanguishene held McGee for a year, refusing to transfer him. In 2006, the chairman of the Provincial Review Board at a tribunal said, quote, "We find it rather offensive that the review board's order from last year has been snubbed. A year ago, an order was made and nothing was done. It could be said that the board's nose is out of joint," end quote. He went on to call for McGee's lawyer to bring a motion citing Penetanguishene for contempt.
I love that Penetanguishene just dug their heels in.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, they had been dealing with this guy.
They knew him.
They knew exactly. I mean, they saw what happened with Peter Woodcock when Woodcock and his partner got out on a day pass, you know? So they'd had a history of these kind of things. After the hearing, in an interview, McGee said, quote, "I'm elated. I'm no longer dangerous. I don't want to hurt anybody. I'm hoping sometime down the road I will be able to go out and visit with my family," end quote. McGee's lawyer said this was a flat-out victory for Chris. "If Chris is not at the Toronto facility by next week, I will go to the Superior Court with a motion calling for contempt charges to be laid against Penetanguishene." He wasn't transferred the following week. In fact, the officials at Penetanguishene launched an appeal with the Supreme Court of Ontario to stop the transfer with the support of the Attorney General. And in 2006, They won.
Yeah.
Justice E.A. Cronk's 27-page ruling didn't mince words as it condemned the review board's decision. Thank goodness. And it goes on to say, quote, "The board's decision was not made after meaningful consideration of the requisite statutory factors, namely the need to protect the public from Mr. McGee. The evidence was that Mr. McGee persists in seeking a transfer to a medium secure facility because he believes that it will facilitate his desired access to women. Mr. McGee's motivation in seeking a transfer should have sounded an alarm bell for the review board," end quote. Good on you, Justice E.A. Cronk.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
It's amazing. It's amazing, right? So they just, when they had the review, Penetang Machine just showed them all the documents and what he was saying. And,
yep.
And
I don't know how this works. Like, I don't know if, do parole boards have a mandate to release a certain number of prisoners a year or two?
Well, this actually went to the Supreme Court of Canada at one point, Mike, where the Supreme Court actually said that somebody who's pent into a mental facility has to be eventually released.
Has to be. Yeah, I was aware of that.
Which is ridiculous, because if you're not getting well and you're going to still murder people,
right,
you should not be out.
No, there are those facilities in the U.S. where sexual predators are held after their actual release from prison,
right,
in a hospital facility to determine whether they are ready to come back into society. And some of them are held there in perpetuity.
Yeah.
So okay. I don't know about the legality of that in Canada. I don't think we could do that. And I don't know about the humanity of that either.
No, but if somebody's still sick and a danger, you can't let them out, right? So let's come back to the people of Strathroy. As we were just discussing, you know, in my research, I saw that a lot of the relatives of the victims were at all of the hearings over the years.
So which is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just one. There was a bunch of them. And they stood up for their loved ones. They spoke at the hearings. They spoke to the media.
Everybody will say, that's what I will do.
Yeah.
But I have seen it over and over again in my research. People get tired.
They get exhausted and they want to move on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, these are strong people and they didn't back off, and I totally applaud them. And I can't imagine what they've gone through. And I think it's in no small part that McGee remained locked up due to their voices against the insanity of the authorities trying to release him.
That was bonkers.
Yeah.
Yeah, he still has fantasies about murdering and, you know, raping and murdering, and then cannibalistic necrophilic ideas.
And he wants access to women.
Yeah.
Right? Ridiculous. I actually talked to my mom about these few years in the early 70s as well, where some of the murders and rapes were a mere 15-minute walk from the house that we were living in.
Yeah.
And she said to me it was really frightening, and that she would lock the doors and windows at night, something that we never did, right? Mm-hmm. But she also said she was thankful that she had both my brother and I, who are only 10 months apart. So she had a 3- and a 4-year-old, and she's like, that kept me at home all the time. I wasn't out and about. Maybe you guys saved me, right?
Yeah.
My relative Stella also said, you know, because I asked her about the girls, and she said, I didn't really know any of the girls that he killed at the time. But she said, we're all young women in a small town. And she said, you know, I always thought that we were just in this small town and crime never happened and it wouldn't happen in a nice community. And after this happened, she said, to be honest, I often worried about the boogeyman around every corner.
Yeah.
It really, you know, it really shook people.
Mm-hmm.
I asked her what her reaction was when McGee was caught, and I found this interesting. She said, horror and sadness. Of course, horror and sadness for the girls. That absolutely goes without saying. But also for Chris. And I think what she meant there, the child Chris.
Yeah.
Right?
So this guy who she knew
as a child.
Yeah.
She didn't know him as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
She said, what turned him into this, into a serial killer? Was it written on the walls all along? How does this happen? I just don't understand it. It's unfathomable.
Yeah. There are a few people from my hometown who, if somebody said, so-and-so's a serial killer, I would say, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But there are others who, you know, they had some darkness about them, but I would be surprised that they went on to hurt somebody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. When it's someone you know. There's all these jokes in the true crime community. It's like, oh, he was a quiet guy, kept to himself, blah, 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 blah. But that's sometimes the truth.
Yeah.
it's not always obvious that the person who is a serial killer is a serial killer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So what I find interesting is this idea of unfathomable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I'll end where we began, going back to the Atwood quote at the beginning of the episode. Quote, in small town Soweto, people's lives were dull, simple, amazing, and unfathomable. Deep caves paved with kitchen linoleum. I love that line.
So the key word is unfathomable.
Yes.
Whoa. Deep caves paved with kitchen linoleum.
Isn't that a great line?
Linoleum. Linoleum is one of those words, you know, when it comes up, you know exactly what people are talking about.
Yeah.
If you live in North America, you know.
Yeah.
And that's it for Dark Poutine episode 187, The Mad Slasher of Strathroy. Matthew, wow.
Hope you guys enjoyed it.
I'm sure they did. They had to have, because I did. Good. I really enjoyed this episode. It was nice to be more of a fly on the wall for an episode for the very first time. I got to be, you know, I've done interview episodes, but I haven't ever done an episode like this. And I enjoyed it immensely.
Do I get to write some more?
I would love it if you wrote some more. It would be fantastic.
Mike, how many people lived in your hometown?
8,000 around. Yeah,
so you and I grew up in sort of the same size of hometown.
Yeah, not...
So you get...
Totally.
You get this sort of...
when you're talking about the park that was split by the road, the park that I remembered was the Duck Pond, and it was very close to our home.
Yeah.
But it was a large park with a massive pond in the middle with ducks, and people would run around it and walk around it and those kind of things. But it's a small town park.
And
there's not much to it. It's just a little park.
Exactly. And I'm doing this research, right? And I remember Mother's Pizza. Somebody I knew whose grandparents owned the news depot that cut across the tracks. I know exactly where it is. I know that phone booth.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And Maitland Street was one street over from my great-grandmother's house.
Right.
Like, it's all right there. That's why I kind of enjoyed, I don't want to say enjoyed because he destroyed so many lives, but looking this history up about...
You were fascinated by it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you felt more connected to it than perhaps a story that took place in, I don't know, Upper Sklavobia or something, you know, some place that you're not familiar with. It's like when I wrote the episode that was the Penny Boudreaux, this woman murdered her daughter, Carissa, her 12-year-old in Bridgewater. It all happened in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's a small town, but that neighborhood is also a small as well.
Yeah.
Every place that was mentioned in that episode, I knew intimately.
Yeah.
Every single place where the girl's body was found, the Sobeys store where they went beforehand, where the mother strangled the daughter was a place where we used to go drinking back in the woods because there was nobody around. These are all like, when you come from a small town and something happens there, the effect on you is massive. Yeah. I hear about a murder in Surrey and I don't feel a real connection with it.
Yeah.
But if I hear about a murder that happened in Bridgewater, where I grew up, because of the size of that town, the intimate connection I have with every corner of it, I really feel a connection to absolutely everything that goes on there. And it's like, whoa, this is heavy, man.
Yeah. I think it's in talking to my relative as well.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me the opportunity to catch up with her and
and
to understand that, you know, the school that she went to. Actually, I'll post a picture of that school tomorrow on the Yumber Yard.
Okay, that's a
great
idea.
Picture of my mom and an aunt and my grandma there.
Oh, wow, fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, number one, for writing that episode. That was great. But now it's time to move on to voicemails.
Voicemails.
We had some people who called us and gave us some love, I think, I hope. We haven't pre-listened to these, so
oh, no.
It could be, you bunch of jerks, I think your show sucks.
Well, let's go.
You know, if it does...
And if somebody does, let's just rip them apart.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if someone calls me and tells me my show sucks, here's the answer that we should have for them. Let's listen to yours. We want to listen to yours.
Let's listen to your show.
All right. I don't know where this one's from, but we'll go for it. Maybe Alberta.
Hey, Matt, Mike. Love listening to the show. Been a long time listener. First time caller. It's Big T here calling from the huge metropolis of Alliance, Alberta. Sitting in a combine, a big old green John Deere right now. So what inspired me to call was listening to episode 185, and Matt came up with the great one line of their cock knocker. Huh. So that was what inspired me. I haven't heard that saying in a real long time, but I do love the show right from episode 1 to 185, and you two cock knockers have yourselves a great day, and I'm going to continue listening to 186 after this, and look forward to 187 and all the other episodes after that. Sorry for the noise. Like I said, I'm in a big old green John Deere combine right now, so adios to you both, and you guys have a real shitty day, and go shit in your heads.
Well, how about that? Thank you so much for that voicemail. I love it when people call from their tractor and call us cock knockers.
That's fantastic. He's in a combine, wasn't he?
He's in a combine.
John Deere. My grandfather had a John Deere combine.
All I recall from my childhood is stories about combine accidents.
Oh, really?
Some kid getting his arm lopped off in a combine.
Yeah,
accident.
No, don't be saying that. The guy's driving a combine. We don't want to make him worry.
What, worry that there's a child in the
don't
field?
Don't be a cock knocker, Mike.
I won't be a cock knocker. But thank you for calling from
thank
your
you
combine.
Thank you so much. That's so cool. I love that.
That is cool. Somewhere in the wilds of Alberta, he was. Let's listen to this one.
Hi, I'm calling to say, first, hi, my name is Andrea, and I'm from Abitibi, Quebec. And I just wanted to say that I listened to you since I was 17, and I'm 21, and I really like your show. And I was listening to it while I was in class. And I don't think my teachers liked it, but I really like you. So thank you, and Boshida Tatuk.
Fantastic.
Wow. That was the most francophone call that I think
I
we've
love
had.
That. Thank you.
The most
you.
Québécois.
I'm off to Quebec tomorrow, Mike.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
And Steve's going to a dog sitter.
A dog sitter. So that caller, what was her name?
Andrea.
Andrea.
Yeah.
Was listening from 17 to 21.
That really struck me, and I'm glad
I,
that
I,
she
I
said
saw the
that.
Look on your face.
It's like
the look was. Ooh, I'm old.
Well, I've been doing this for a while. So you started when you were a teenager, and now you're an adult, and you're still listening.
That's
I'm
awesome.
Really sorry.
No, that's really cool.
Whoa, that is crazy. But thank you for your call.
Thank you, Andrea.
Andrea, very nice. This one might also be from Alberta. We're having a lot of Albertans calling, but, you know.
They're a friendly people.
They really are.
Hey, Mike and Matthew. It's Ryan from... Well, I guess we're the Texas of Canada and Alberta here. Just wanted to call you after this week's episode. I'm an avid Dark Boutique fan for years. Mike, Matthew Into the Mix has made this podcast possibly one of the best I listen to. I just want to thank both of you for your perspectives on 9/11 that you shared this week. You took a very intelligent, thoughtful approach to the aftermath of this attack. Matthew, I think at one point you said you felt like you were getting worked up, but I would tend to say you were actually extremely factual and very articulate. So 9/11, working as a volunteer firefighter at that time, and because of 9/11, I spent the majority of the last 2 decades working in emergency services. I started as an EMT and firefighter, and I transitioned into working as a police officer for about a decade before depression and PTSD kind of led me to having to pick up a nice cozy desk job. But let's be honest, this isn't about me. No one gives a shit about my story. It's about you two. So I just wanted to thank you for the respectful way you approach not only the 9/11 story, but all the stories you share. You truly remind us that the stories are not and should not be about the perpetrator, but rather the victims and their loved ones. So I just wanted to say thanks to you guys and tell you to go shit in your hat, you hosers.
Well, that's great. Thank you for your service, number one, in all the different branches of service that
That's incredible.
That is incredible. I trained as a junior fireman in my early days, my days back in Bridgewater, and a lot of the junior firemen transitioned to the grown-up fire department afterward. I moved away. Otherwise, I'd probably be a volunteer fireman in Bridgewater right now. But
can I say something inappropriate?
About firemen and calendars and hoses?
So you take a guy who's like a solid six, mm-hmm. put him in a fireman's uniform.
Yeah.
And he's like a solid 9.5.
Oh, wow. So, no, thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you.
And
that's great.
I've had a few messages about that episode that we did on 9/11, and it really did strike me and in a number of ways. One of the victims of 9/11 was somebody a friend knew. He was the pastor who was killed by falling debris and victim 0001 of the day. So, it's really 9/11 was a tough one for us to cover because we were alive then and we remembered it, and it really had a big impact on my life at the time. And people who are first responders and those kind of things, I think those are the guys we should be paying like rock stars.
I don't understand. Okay, Mike.
I mean, there's a lot more of them than there are rock stars.
Firefighters, police officers, yeah. Nurses.
Doctors.
Doctors.
Well, doctors get paid pretty good. Some of them.
Some of them. But honestly, like, you look at what they do in the work and versus somebody like me who sells cannabis for a living and makes a good living.
Mm-hmm.
I feel guilty about it.
You feel guilty?
Yeah.
Why?
I'm just joking. I don't feel that guilty.
You don't feel guilty.
But my point being, honestly, it's they get shortchanged, I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
So that's it for this week's voicemails. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can do so at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARKPTN.
PTN.
And you know what? Write it out. Don't write it out. Whatever. If you're comfortable talking, that's a good thing.
Practice in front of the mirror.
Practice in front. Oh, I don't like practicing in front of a mirror. That is not a, it's not fun for me to do.
Okay.
I can't stand to watch myself. I don't know what it is. I can't stand to listen to myself, but I have to. So I had to get used to it.
Well, I can stand watching myself. I can't stand listening to myself.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. All right. I guess it is time to move on to Patreon. Let's see if anybody gave us some love this week.
Give us your love.
So as far as Patreon goes, this week we have Elizabeth Reardon, and she's from Cargill, Ontario. Another Ontarian.
Another Ontarian.
So thanks, Liz. What does Liz do there in Cargill, Ontario? I just think of, isn't Cargill the thing you see on trains? Isn't that a company? Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not sure. But she makes amphibious cars.
She makes amphibious cars?
Yeah.
Oh, I've always actually kind of wanted
Cargill. Actually, I saw a video.
Cargill,
I know. Bada boom. I saw a video with an amphibious car just this morning, actually.
I really have wanted one of those since I was a child.
Like the 1950s looking ones with the fins?
Yeah, like all of the above.
Red?
And anything.
Red?
I would like actually an amphibious like car submarine thing.
Okay. Well, hit her up. She designs them.
Well, there you go. Liz, please.
Thanks, Liz.
Please. I would definitely require one of those.
Thank you for Patreoning.
Thank you for Patreoning, for sure. From somewhere we're not sure of, or at least I'm not, Matthew knows, Shauna Talbot. Shauna. Where is Shauna from?
Shauna is from Petrolia.
Petrolia? Is it a petrol
actually,
place?
Actually, it's not far from Strathroy.
Oh, okay.
So Petrolia mm-hmm. was Canada's Victorian oil town, and it's
I was right, Petrolia.
Yeah, oh, Petrolia. Okay. It's often credited with actually starting the oil industry in North America. One of the first places where they got oil in North America.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Thank you, Shauna Talbot from Petrolia. And what does she do there?
She
pumps gas.
Looks after the Fitzgerald rig.
What is that?
It's a rig that's been in service since 1903, and she's an engineer to keep it going.
Oh, that's really cool.
Oil rig. It's a 1903 oil rig, and she keeps it running.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Shona. That's it for Patreon. Let's move on to PayPal. So this week, Donut Money Donor,
yeah.
Teresa Temlett.
Hello, Teresa.
And I don't know where Teresa's from either. I know she's not from Petrolia or Cargill.
No.
Where is she from?
She's from the Big Island, Hawaii.
Oh, man.
I want to go to Hawaii so bad.
I would love to go to Hawaii. I have never been. It is sort of on my bucket list of things to do. Do the volcanoes still erupt there? Are they continually erupting? I just have this vision of a continuous erupting volcano.
I think some keep spewing a little bit,
okay.
Right?
And so there's
areas
see?
Where you can go and see this, and that's why I want to go. I want to see the volcanoes.
Yeah, I want to see nature doing its thing. I want to see a new piece of land because of a volcano. Yeah, it's so cool.
It is.
Yeah, and obviously Hawaii looks really pretty, and I hear the food's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the weather. So all the things.
Let's go.
Yeah. I'm up for it. And maybe we should do a...
Isn't Dog the Bounty Hunter from Hawaii?
Yeah. With his hair.
With his hair.
That mullet. Like, all business up front and a real serious party in the back. But I don't know. Maybe we should do a meetup in Hawaii.
Oh, that'd be great.
Let's go to Hawaii and have a meetup. Dark Poutine. Yeah, we could.
Excellent.
Yeah, we could totally expense it. No problem.
Thank you, tax man.
Exactly. Well, that is it for our Donut Money donors and Patreons this week. Thank you so much. Thank you to you all, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us Donut Money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Please pre-order my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem. There's a link to it on the Dark Poutine website, or you can search for it, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem by Mike Brown, that's Brown with an E, at any major retailer like Amazon and Indigo here in Canada, and other booksellers, other fantastic booksellers. If you would like, check out our website, darkpoutine.com, for show notes and other cool stuff. Please take the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. Until next week, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.